Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. When Stax Records first started making recordings in the late 50s, it was a small two-person operation working out of a garage in Memphis. 10 years later, the label had scored huge soul, gospel, and blues hits with artists like Booker T and the MGs, Otis Redding, and Sam and Dave. Recently, we spoke with author Robert Gordon about Stax Records' legacy, which he argues isn't just a musical one. Later on the show, we'll revisit that conversation about how the label became a place where black and white people worked together during the turbulent times of the civil rights movement. Now, Stax Records is actually still around today. It was bought by Concord Records back in 2004 and relaunched a few years later. Booker T himself even recently put out an album on the label, and that album featured a young blues guitarist named Gary Clark Jr. Gary Clark Jr.'s big break came in 2010 when Eric Clapton invited him to play the Crossroads Guitar Festival, and from there, his career has skyrocketed. He joined us here on Soundcheck to play a solo set in late 2013 and started us off with my personal favorite from his debut album, a song called When My Train Pulls In.
Every day, nothing seemed to change. Everywhere I go, I keep seeing the same old thing. And I can't take it no more. Well, I would leave this town, but I ain't got nowhere else to go, no. Wake up in the morning, more bad news, and sometimes I feel like I was born to lose, and it's driving me out of my mind. I'm gonna catch the next train, then I'll move on down the line. Well, I'll be ready now. I'll be ready when my train pulls in. Boy, I'll be ready now. I'll be ready when my train pulls in. I know my time ain't long, and I can't live this life again. Thank you. Walking down the street, you might run across a smiling face, but they'll stab you in the back as soon as you turn and walk away. And I, Lord, it's bringing me down. Well, if things don't change around here, ain't no use in me hanging around, hanging around. Well, I'll be ready now. I'll be ready when my train pulls in. Well, I'll be ready now, yeah. I'll be ready when my train pulls in. I know my time ain't long and I can't live this life again.
You sure you're done there now? Because that piece ended like three times.
Yeah, that is the finale. That's it. I promise I'm done.
When My Train Pulls In, that is Gary Clark Jr. live on Soundcheck. Band? Who needs a band?
Yeah, those guys, whatever.
The band version sounds great on the record Black and Blue, but man, it's so much fun to see you and hear you doing this solo stuff live here on Soundcheck today. Mm-hmm. People talk about you as if you sort of materialized out of thin air, you know, the overnight success.
Yeah.
And the last couple of years have been pretty busy for you, I guess.
Yeah, definitely.
But, you know, does it feel like it happened really suddenly for you?
Yeah, actually. I mean, I was just kind of taking my time with everything. You know, I've been playing out. Gigging since I was 14, you know, mm-hmm. a freshman in high school, and a few years ago, just like it went from cruising, you know, maybe 50 miles an hour
uh-huh.
to like the Autobahn, you know what I mean? It's crazy.
So, you know, you're featured in the movie Honey Dripper.
Yeah.
Some of your music is in 12 Years a Slave.
Right.
Where did you start? I mean, you're from Austin, right?
Yeah.
Austin, Texas. When did you first pick up the guitar?
I first picked up the guitar in 96. I was begging my parents to get me a guitar for years. And they were like, oh, you're just going to, you know, lose interest like you do with everything, baseball and football or whatever, you know, like, I quit, you know. And, so they're reluctant. And finally in 96, I started playing. A friend of mine, Eve Monse, she had a band down the street. And it was like an awesome trio, like rock and roll, blues mm-hmm. girls. They're all cute. I had a crush on every single one of them. And so I would just hang out there and play video games like her dad would repair video games. So I just hung out there and would listen and learn that way. And then for her 15th birthday, she wanted to go to a blues jam down on 6th Street. And so we just started there at a place called Babes.
Mm-hmm.
And
for folks who don't know Austin, 6th Street is sort of the lifeblood of that. That's where most of the South by Southwest festival takes place.
Right,
a lot
right,
of clubs
right.
and bars.
I mean, it's just music like all hours, you know.
Now, but you're growing up in Austin, so you're growing up in the considerable shadow cast by the late Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with that as a guitarist coming up in that town?
I mean, that's kind of heavy. You got to do something different. Like, it's, you know, there's a reason I don't play a Stratocaster, and it's because when I get on a Strat, like, all I want to do is play like Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Yeah.
You know, like, he's so big there and has such a major influence on the blues scene, like, you can just tell. So, I mean, it's hard. It's hard to not want to play that all the time because it's so great. It's such a big influence on me and, like, so many other musicians down there.
So you had to find your own way, and where did you look? Who were your guitar heroes? Who were your musical heroes?
Well, in Austin, Derek O'Brien, a great guitar player. He backed up everybody from Muddy Waters to B.B. King, Albert Collins, Alan Haynes, Tony Redman, W.C. Clark. Those were the guys that I was watching in Austin, and then at the same time I was listening to stuff like Nirvana and Rolling Stones and Curtis Mayfield, Outkast, Tupac. You know, I was listening to everything. So anything that had guitar in it, I would just try and learn. Isley Brothers. So I picked up a lot of stuff from that, consciously and subconsciously, you know.
And at some point, Hendrix must have been in the mix somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, I think that kind of goes without saying. Yeah. Like, you just, if you play guitar and you aren't influenced, you're missing out.
Now, you mentioned the Stones. You've played with them, right?
Yeah.
Wow. What was that like?
It was crazy. I mean, I don't even...
Where were you?
We were here in New York. We did... The spot in Brooklyn.
Celebrate Brooklyn? No.
No. The big...
Barclays Center?
Barclays, yeah.
Okay.
Did that, and we were out in New Jersey, and I got to play with them in Hyde Park. I mean, it's just crazy that they invite me. I mean, it's like the biggest band in the world, and to think they want me to actually get up there and play guitar, it's like... I haven't really soaked that up yet, you know? I haven't had time to really...
process that.
Yeah.
Well, you know, they're the biggest band in the world. They are also arguably the biggest blues fans in the world.
Yeah.
So they know from blues.
Exactly.
They know it when they hear it, and obviously they hear something in you. On the album, there's a song called Bright Lights, which is one of those great kind of waking up in New York City stories.
Yeah.
As people listen to this, is it just a story, or was there any kind of truth to this tale?
Yeah, I mean, it's very, very true. I think it was my first time up here. I was young, and I didn't really know what to expect. You know, I landed at JFK and took the train, got out Grand Central Station, Penn Station, and I just kind of, like, walked out into this madness, and I was just kind of wandering with my camera, and I ran into some friends that I knew from Austin. They were just hanging out at this spot outside, and they ended up taking me all over the city and ended up shutting a lot of places down, and then I just woke up in front of this hair salon, and this woman was, like, kicked me, and she's like, "You're bad for business." And I was like, "What? What just happened?" You know? And, so that's where Bright Lights came from. You know, I had to be on a plane and head back to Austin. I had a gig that night, and I was late, and just, like, a whole lot of things, like, turned for me. I was like, okay, wow, you gotta be careful.
Yeah.
And take yourself seriously, and, you know, and I got caught up, and that's kind of what it was about.
All right.
You know?
Well, and sometimes the universe just deposits a song right there in your lap.
Exactly.
Let's hear it. It's called Bright Lights from my guest Gary Clark Jr., playing live solo on Soundcheck.
Thank you.
Woke up in New York City lying on the floor. Just outside of Morse's West 54th. You're gonna know my name by the end of the night. Yeah. You're gonna know my name by the end of the night. Yeah. Bright lights, big city going to my head. Bright lights, big city going to my head. Bright lights, big city going to my head. I don't care, no, 'cause you don't care, no. Start off with the bottle, ended up with the bottle. Taking shots, waiting on tomorrow, trying to fill up what's hollow. You gonna know my name. Well, you gonna know my name. Bright lights, big city going to my head. Bright lights, big city going to my head. Bright lights, big city going to my head. I don't care, no, no, 'cause you don't care, no. Try to find myself. I went up, different person came down, somebody else. I know it ain't right, but it's all in my head. Whoa, I'm surprised that I'm still alive. I should be dead. Bright lights, big city going to my head. Bright lights, big city going to my head. Bright lights, big city going to my head. I don't care, no, 'cause you don't care, no. Well, you gonna know my name. Well, you gonna know my name. Well, you gonna know my name. Yeah. Well, you gonna know my name by the end of the night.
That's Gary Clark Jr. with his song Bright Lights. Up next, more music from him, and later, a look at the history of the Memphis-based Stax record label. That's all coming up on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, back now with blues guitarist and singer Gary Clark Jr., whose resume includes performing with the Rolling Stones and for President Obama. Let's hear another song. Live in the studio, this is Gary Clark Jr. with Next Door Neighbor Blues.
Got a call from my neighbor this morning. Told me my baby was gone. Got a call from my neighbor this morning. Told me my baby was gone. Took the keys of my Cadillac, left my clothes out on the lawn. Came home last night to a pistol pointed at my head. Came home last night to a pistol pointed at my head. She said, "You better fess up, boy, or I swear I'm gonna shoot you dead." Something was wrong. Something wrong been going on. I should have known. Something wrong been going on. When my neighbor called me, not soon after did I find out that little girl moved in next door.
Something like that is fine for us. Gary Clark Jr. with a version of Next Door Neighbor Blues live solo on Soundcheck. So for folks who are not guitarists, when I asked you a moment ago whether you were playing in standard tuning or not, that song's in open G.
Mm-hmm.
And the difference is that with open G, if you just strum without using your left hand at all, just strum the strings, you get a G chord.
Yeah.
So everything's all, you know, it's everything's resonant and the strings all resonate with each other.
Yeah, it's it makes you play different. You know, it's inspiring in a way to switch up tuning and try and figure it out. It's like starting from scratch. You know.
Yeah, I mean, it's always amazed me. Guitarists like, I don't know, Leo Kottke or even the guys from Sonic Youth. You know, where they have like different tunings for every song and maybe a different guitar for. It's like you're basically playing a completely different instrument now. You've got all the notes are in different places.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you play in a lot of tunings, or you just have a handful that you like to?
No, I pretty much stick to standard. because I tend to get lost. Like it happened just now. I was like, wait. But
is that true? Did you get a little lost there?
I did. You know, I've been playing in open D, trying to do that as well. So, it's not automatic for me yet.
Okay.
But so yeah, so I try and just stick to the standard deal.
All right. Now, obviously, with a title like Next Door Neighbor Blues, the blues is a big part of that. It's a big part of what you do. Mm-hmm. But folks who listen to Black and Blue will hear, there's a pretty strong R&B element to what you do, and alt rock and lots of other stuff, it seems.
Yeah, I was told that I was musically schizophrenic.
That sounds dangerous.
It does sound dangerous.
Who told you that?
This guy, Jamie Soretta. Shout out to Jamie. Yeah, a nice guy from California.
So he meant well.
I think so. He was smiling when he said it.
So when you have the band with you, and especially, when you're in a studio situation, as you would have been while making this record, does that change the song? I mean, the songs were written before you got in the studio, presumably, right?
Right. Most of them, all except for Glitter Ain't Gold, Jumping for Nothing. All of them, yeah, I pretty much had the ideas, and Mike Elizondo helped me with arrangements.
Bass player and producer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Awesome.
Worked
guy.
With Fiona Apple and so many others.
Yeah. So he was great at helping me arrange because, and kind of tighten things up.
Yeah.
Because like you asked me earlier, is Train going to be as long as it is on the record? And that version, as long as it is, was longer.
Train kept a rolling all night long is what you're telling me.
I kind of get lost playing a guitar solo. I love to play guitar so much that I kind of get lost in it. And so they had to tell me, back off. But for the most part, we came in with the ideas and it was pretty much finished when we got in.
Well, the album is called Black and Blue, and it is out there. You should check it out. Gary Clark Jr. has been playing live solo for us here in the Soundcheck studio. Looking forward to whatever you come up with next time you get a chance. But in the meantime, I know it's continuing to be a busy time for you.
Yeah.
Enjoy it, Gary. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, we revisit the heyday of Stax Records and listen back to some of the label's biggest hits. That's next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Sam and Dave, Otis Redding, Isaac Hayes, the Staple Singers, this band, Booker T and the MGs, these are just some of the soul stars whose careers were established at Stax Records. The label began in a Memphis garage and went on to produce hundreds of hit songs, and Stax was more than just a record label, according to Memphis music historian Robert Gordon. In his new book, Gordon argues that Stax was a refuge from the harsh racial realities of the 1960s South and a reflection of the turbulent civil rights movement churning just beyond its doors. The book is called Respect Yourself, Stax Records and the Soul Explosion. And Robert Gordon joins me now, appropriately from Memphis. Robert, welcome to Soundcheck.
Howdy, howdy. Thanks for having me.
Now, you hear a lot going on in this song, Green Onions, by Booker T and the MGs. What's in here that's not just a neat pop instrumental?
Well, I think there's a lot of tension in this song. I think you hear the underlying racial animosity in Memphis. You hear the wariness of Booker and Steve, of the public outside. You know, mm-hmm.
Booker being the black keyboardist, Booker T. Jones, right. And Steve being Steve Cropper, the white guitarist. So it's a mixed race group.
Exactly, and it sort of began as an accident in the early 1960s, and the music worked, you know. So, Booker told me if it had been a conscious effort, it would have been foolish to undertake this as a conscious effort at that time in that place.
So, Stax, you know, both through this band and through the way the company would grow over the years, does become this kind of refuge from a Memphis that, like much of the South, is riven with racial strife. How did that happen? I mean, it's a white guy and his sister. It's Jim Stewart and his sister Estelle Axton, who are the founders of the record label.
I'm going to take it to Dewey Phillips for a second, who was a disc jockey in Memphis, a white disc jockey who transcended race, played R&B to a white and a black audience. It was the first one to play Elvis Presley. And when Dewey would greet his audience, he would say, "All right, good people." So he wasn't talking to black and he wasn't talking to white. He was talking to good people. And I think that Jim and Estelle, the founders of Stax, were good people. And they said, there's this madness going on outside about people who hate people based on the color of their skin, but we're just going to run our business and deal with good people.
So they open up in this Memphis garage. Then they eventually take over this disused theater in what is... Well, it was a black neighborhood mostly in Memphis.
Change. It was a neighborhood in transition, change. The early days of white flight, yeah.
Right. So how did Stax find its artists? Was it as simple as these are the people who walk in off the street through the front door?
It was as simple as that. They walked in through the front door into a record store. Mm-hmm. Estelle, the sister, established a record store on the candy counter of the theater, you know, like where you'd buy your popcorn.
Right.
And Steve Cropper was a clerk in that store. So they would kind of, you know, get to talking to people. And Booker said he always knew he could hear the music coming from the back of the place, from the theater, but he never could get back there until until the one session. But these guys would, Estelle and Steve, you know, were on the lookout. And the talent, can I just list the talent? Some of the talent that walked in the door?
Sure.
Walked in the door. I mean, Rufus Thomas, Carla Thomas, William Bell, Otis Redding. It just goes, you know, the Mad Lads, these were people, the Barkays, people who lived in the neighborhood who walked in the door.
And you mentioned that Booker T, you know, he's hearing the music in the back, but he can't get back there till his first session. Was his first session the Carla and Rufus Thomas song?
Exactly right. He was in school, and David Porter, the songwriter who would compose a lot of the hits like Soul Man and Hold On, I'm Coming with Isaac Hayes, he was in there with Rufus and Carla. So David went because he wanted to see what the session was like. When they said, "Hey, we need a baritone sax player," David went and got his friend Booker T out of algebra class.
Out of school, yeah. That's a great story. And the results is really the first hit for Stax Records. And as Robert Gordon is telling us, these guys, they just walked in off the street. Rufus Thomas and his daughter Carla Thomas with 'Cause I Love You. That is Carla and Rufus Thomas with 'Cause I Love You, recorded in the Stax studio in the early 60s, early hit for the burgeoning soul label there in Memphis, Tennessee, the subject of the book Respect Yourself, Stax Records and the Soul Explosion by Robert Gordon, who's with me on soundcheck. And again, in the background there, Booker T is playing baritone sax, not keyboard yet, although that would come later.
He didn't even consider himself a keyboard player. He considered himself a guitarist,
which
is wild
anything.
To think about.
Yeah.
He could play anything.
There are so many unusual and improbable stories of how Jim and Estelle, the founders of Stax, got to meet these various musicians. None of them more improbable than the story of how they met Otis Redding.
This guy in Georgia had cut a hit, and the people in New York thought maybe he would gel well with Booker T and the MGs. So they brought him up from Macon, Georgia to Memphis, and the guys were waiting for him outside. He pulls up. Everybody talks about the driver getting out and starting to unload gear. They go, oh, no, man, it's okay. We're a recording studio, and we actually have the gear inside, and it's set up. Mm-hmm. So the guy brought in food and clothes. He just lugged the stuff for the star. And the star was a showman, and they couldn't really get a groove going in this studio. He was more of a stage player.
He would play the guitar behind his back and that sort of thing.
Right.
Yeah.
So it was getting really frustrating, and people had to get out of the studio for their club gigs. Al Jackson, the drummer, had promised the driver he would give him a listen, and he comes running down at the end, and Steve Cropper says, okay, guy, you know, show me what you do. And when the guy started to sing, when Otis started to sing, Steve ran outside and got, you know, he had to tell Louis Steinberg, get your bass out of the car, man. I need you inside.
Yeah, you got to hear this.
And they cut what became his first single on Stax, These Arms of Mine.
The story is so funny, but it sort of reflects really well on their openness to people
exactly.
who were unknown. And boy, did they profit from it, because Otis Redding would churn out hit after hit, including this one.
What you want, honey, you got it. And what you need, baby, you got it. All I'm asking for a little respect when I come home.
To fade it out. I just want to hear the rest of that.
I'm dancing, John. I'm dancing.
Oh, man. Respect. The original version from Otis Redding, recorded in 1965 on Stax Records. And Robert, I was saying that, you know, they would profit from their open minds and open ears. 2 years later, in 67, Aretha Franklin has a huge hit with it. So those mm-hmm. publishing royalties are coming in. So as your story progresses, it progresses sort of in tandem with the sanitation strike there in Memphis, the racial divide, Martin Luther King coming because of the sanitation strike. And, of course, that's where he is assassinated. And the place where he is killed is a place that's kind of part of the Stax lore, isn't it?
Absolutely. The Lorraine Motel was about the only place in town where the Stax people could go relax. There was no air conditioning in the theater that was their recording studio. So they would go swim in the pool, you know,
mm-hmm.
white and black together. They could get served in the coffee shop at the hotel together. And all their artists who came from out of town to record with them would stay at the Lorraine. It was black owned. It was downtown, not too far away. Yeah, it was their clubhouse.
And, you know, obviously the death of Martin Luther King, a major turning point for the country, but for Stax as well, death rears its ugly head a couple of times. Mm. And, of course, the big one for them is Otis Redding. Is that really a turning point? Is that when things begin to go bad for Stax?
In a period of between the end of or middle of December and early April, when Dr. King's assassinated, they get three pieces of terrible, terrible news that would certainly have taken most companies to their knees. Those three news bits being the death of Otis Redding, and not only Otis Redding, but the Barquets.
Most of the band, yeah.
Who were kids from the neighborhood who had worked in one was a shoeshine boy in the barbershop next to the theater, you know, and they all had just hung out with the MGs, learned to play, had a hit with Soulfinger. They were the kids, you know,
mm-hmm.
and so the next generation was wiped out with Otis.
You actually, in the book, you actually list the names and ages of everybody who was on that small plane that went down. And, you know, it's just heartbreaking to see 18, 19. And by contrast, Otis Redding and the pilot at 26 are by far the old men in this group.
It is absolutely heartbreaking. And the account I got from Ben Colley, the survivor of the plane crash, just spine tingling. I mean, But the third piece of news is that a deal that Stax has signed with Atlantic, which Jim hadn't read before signing, and he had signed away ownership of everything that was put out. It was devastating news.
You talked to Jerry Wexler, who was the head of Atlantic, who did this deal with Jim Stewart and Stax. Right. And he protests that he knew nothing about it, that his lawyers slipped it in, and that when Atlantic was in turn being swallowed up by Warner Brothers, he said, hey, I want to do right by these guys and give them their master tapes. And the folks at Warner said, no, we have a deal, and that's how we're going to do it. You make it pretty clear that you're not buying Jerry Wexler's story.
He told me that story that you just told me in answer to my first question to him, which was, you were in New York and Stax was this little label in Memphis. How did you hear about them? My question was as innocent as that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was the first thing I asked him. And within about 60 seconds, he was defending, one might say, protesting too much.
Yeah. Well, you do say that. I think that's the exact phrase you use. He doth protest too much. So, as you say, it's a triple blow to the folks at Stax. And yet, it does not bring them to their knees. They
had a secret weapon.
And what was that?
That was a guy named Al Bell. He was what they called the Otis Redding of business.
Mm.
You know, he was, and I called him a rocket in wingtips. He helped Stax figure out how to come back from this devastation, which was to realize they had all the parts that they used to have. They had songwriters, they had artists, they had a recording studio, and he put all that to work in creating the Soul Explosion, which was the simultaneous release of 28 albums and 27 singles.
And one of those songwriters would become a kind of game changer, a landmark in African American music, and that is Isaac Hayes. And man, he just went from strength to strength to the point where, you know, he did the famous theme from the movie Shaft, which, you know, forget about winning a Grammy. He won an Oscar for this,
yep,
which is, again, simply unheard of. Possibly the most famous piece of pop music to have come out of Stax. Here is Isaac Hayes with the theme from Shaft.
Who's the black private dick that's a sex machine to all the chicks? Damn right. Who is the man that would risk his neck for his brother, man? Can you dig it? Who's the cat that won't cop out when there's danger all about? Right on.
Isaac Hayes and the award-winning theme from the film Shaft, a high watermark for the record label Stax.
Mm-hmm.
And Robert, I said, you know, pop music. You make the distinction that Motown was making pop music. Stax, for much of the 60s, was making soul music. But as the 70s happen, as Al Bell is working his magic with all these radio stations, they really begin to become more diffuse, more eclectic. And it seems that as the house of cards goes taller and taller, the whole thing begins to waver and then eventually crumbles. What was at the heart of that?
I think that Al ultimately was motivated to give middle-class existence to black people who had been denied middle-class existence up to that point in time. Al wants to become basically what Atlantic had been to them for other labels. So he is signing labels and signing artists and signing hits and distributing and releasing. And he begins to expand the staff at Stax. At one point, there's over 200 people on staff. The numbers got so big, things got out of control, and Isaac was this goose laying golden eggs every time. The whole second period of Stax is really built on the success of Isaac Hayes mm-hmm. as an artist, as a recording artist.
And on a cozy relationship with a local bank, which also turns out...
Again, you know, the improbable, the word improbable returns. It so happens that Stax is this stream of money, and a guy at the bank realizes he can do some embezzling, begins to forge signatures. Mm-hmm. Stax is overextended more than they know. And then, well, the ultimate thing is they make a deal with Columbia. Jim Stewart wants out. Columbia is the biggest distributor in the world. Al reaches the pinnacle of his achievement because now he can get his records everywhere that Columbia can ship them, or so he thinks. Because soon after they make the deal, soon after Jim Stewart cashes out, the deal with Columbia goes south, and Stax finds that no matter what it presses up and delivers for distribution, it's not getting in the stores.
Right.
CBS denies responsibility, but there's lots of evidence that records weren't getting in stores, and that becomes a stranglehold.
We're speaking with Robert Gordon, the Grammy-winning Memphis music historian, about his book, Respect Yourself, about the story of Stax Records. Why do you call it Respect Yourself? You say this song is Stax's legacy. Why?
Well, it's a beautiful and simple message, and I think it is the heart of what went on at Stax. When Jim and Estelle opened their door to black people, despite the city telling them not to, it was a matter of respect, you know, and respect is at the core of good relations between people, mm-hmm. and that's what Stax was, and you hear that in the music.
Staple Singers with Respect Yourself. The book is Respect Yourself, Stax Records and the Soul Explosion by my guest Robert Gordon, the Grammy-winning Memphis music historian. So, Robert, in sum, it's not just a Memphis story. It becomes an American story. Is it an American tragedy, or is there a second act?
Well, there's a third act. It's a story with two triumphs and two terrible tragedies, two fortunes made, both fortunes lost. And then the building was closed in 75. In 1989, they were tearing the building down. And then like 10 years after that, maybe 15 years after that, they began to rebuild the building brick by brick from the original design. And now stands the Stax Museum of American Soul Music, which is really just a front for the organization's educational efforts. It began as an after-school program for kids in the neighborhood to get help with their homework, and it's turned into a charter school with six or seven grades. Last year, the second graduating class finished. For the second time in a row, they had 100% college participation, you know, people going on to college.
Wow.
And one girl last year got a full ride to Brown. So there was a long, awful quiet on that corner that has been followed by the return of the spirit, frankly. I mean, it is the rehabilitation of the spirit of all the good that was at Stax.
Well, that's great to hear. And, of course, there is the music, classic American music from the vaults there at Stax Records. There is so much more that you'll find in Robert Gordon's book, Respect Yourself, Stax Records and the Soul Explosion. Robert, great to have you with us today.
Thank you, John. It's been a real blast, and you seem like a soul man.
I'm a soul man. And now, Soundcheck looks back at the pop charts of yesteryear and asks,
that was a hit?
Everybody was kung fu fighting.
They're coming to take me away, haha.
Joe Levy of Billboard returns with yet another top 40 hit that enjoyed improbable success. Hey, Joe.
Hey, how are you?
What is today's improbable song of yesteryear?
I am going to bring to you right now the very worst rap hit of 1990. And you're going to stop me and say, I know this one. I've heard Vanilla Ice's Ice Ice Baby. And I'm going to tell you there was something worse on the charts in 1990, and that was Candyman's Knockin' Boots.
She blew me a kiss. I knew she wasn't new to this. I didn't want you, but the devil made me do it. To the tick-tock, you don't stop. We knock boots till 6 o'clock as we lay. All night long and early in the morning, she sang this song.
Ooh, boy, I love you so. Never, ever, ever gonna let you go. Once I get my hands on you. Ooh, boy, I love you so. Never, ever, ever gonna let you go. I hope you feel the same way too.
Girl, I do.
Knockin' Boots. That was a hit in 1990 for Candyman.
That was a hit in 1990, but wait. It gets worse. That wasn't just a hit for like a week. That spent almost a half a year on the charts. 23 weeks on the charts. It went top 10. It was a big hit. It was there for a long time. You listen to it now and you say, oh, Joe, come on, man. It's not that bad. It's some, you know, lame-ass booty rap, but it's not terrible. But here's the thing. This was the year, again, of Vanilla Ice's Ice Ice Baby. And compared to Candyman, Vanilla Ice can flow.
Yeah.
Compared to Candyman, Vanilla Ice is a lyrical genius. What sinks Candyman's Knockin' Boots is the rapping.
Yeah.
The rhymes are terrible.
The hook's okay.
The hook is okay, but the flow is awful. And this is a guy who, you know, he's telling us about his reputation as a panty dropper. He's the candy man. Ladies love his flavor. And here is the thing. He is using rhymes like, rest your breast on my chest. Yes, I'm impressed. No, no, Candyman. That is not going to get you what you want.
Rest your breasts on my chest. Yes, I'm impressed with the way you cold love me down. I don't want to sit down. I just want to get down. I'm on the ground down on my knees.
Now, where did this guy, I mean, he was all over the radio, as you say, for a good portion of that year. Where did this guy come from?
He was apparently a Tone Loke discovery. If you listen to the very start of this song, you're going to hear, hey, you're going to think, this is not going to be so bad. Why? Because it's Tone Loke talking. Candyman hasn't gotten to us yet.
Right. But Tone Loke, just to remind folks, is the guy who did Wild Thing and had a whole bunch of other hits as the 80s became the 90s.
Tone Loke was on the Delicious Vinyl label out of Los Angeles. He had this wonderful raspy delivery. He had that one big hit, a couple of others, but there's nothing wrong with Tone Loke songs. You listen to them and you understand why they're hits. In point of fact, if you listen to the start of this song, you might say, yeah, I wouldn't mind maybe listening to 2-3 more minutes of this.
Attention, all ladies. The Candyman is on the prowl. And for those that want to get busy, you got to speak up now.
This rhyme, this time, is one of a kind.
Unfortunately, it becomes a Candyman song.
Whatever became of Candyman?
I believe if you go to Spotify, you will find several late-period Candyman records.
Which would be, what, 91, 92?
No, more recent than that. But I will say this. I could not bring myself to investigate them more deeply. This is a song that I remember. I remember from the time, and I remember thinking, no, this is not good. I believe in pop. I believe in public taste. I believe in the charts. I'm always fascinated. Even if I don't like it, I think it's telling us something. It's telling us something about the relationship between the audience and the performer. And all I could think when I heard this was, we've reached a moment that we must escape from.
Well, Wikipedia has this to say about Candyman. Candyman's latest effort to revive his career. Get this, Joe, you're going to love it. Knockin' Boots 2001, A Sex Odyssey. Was a critical and commercial failure. The lead track, a remake of Knockin' Boots, chronicles some of the pleasures found in a night out with the Candyman, including, quote, front row tickets to a bomb-ass play, a relaxing bath, dinner reservations, strawberries in the tub, whipped cream, champagne, and the music of R&B supergroup LSG, unquote.
That's right, and if you look on the bed, I picked you up a little something. I hope it compliments your elegance, and don't worry your pretty little head on how much I spent. Business is good. And
wow, that does actually sound like a pretty good evening, but not necessarily a particularly good song. A bomb-ass play.
A bomb-ass play.
I like that they're going out to the theater. Because Candyman will spend some money on you. He's not going to just take you to a movie. He's going to take you to a play. That's like double digits right there.
Oh, my God.
He's spending some money.
Knockin' Boots 2001, A Sex Odyssey. That was not a hit. But Knockin' Boots, that was a hit. Oh, yeah. Joe Levy, once again, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
Knockin' while I'm hip-hoppin'. Many people say my lyrics are shocking. Just because of the simple subject. Everyone should love this because everybody does it.
Soundcheck is a production of WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team, which could include at any given time Paul Schneider, Bill O'Neill, Rick Kwan, or Jason Isaac. The show is produced by Katie Bishop, Dan O'Donnell, and Mike Katziff, with Amy Pearl and Henry Malofsky, and our interns Bailey Constis, Haley Shaw, and Cooper Mackey. Our executive producer is Joel Meyer. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.